When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
The following podcast contains explicit language. The XX Gabfest is sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, February 21st, the Don Henley Was Hot edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, editor of XX. I'm joined in New York by Noreen Malone of The New Republic. Hi, Noreen.
Hey, Hannah.
And also Allison Benedict, the other editor of XX. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Hannah.
Before we start, I just want to thank everyone for coming to our live podcast in D.C. last week, and particularly the people who came to our awesome cocktail party before the podcast.
And I want to thank Ginny, who gave me, through Noreen, a really beautiful green hat for my hopefully soon-to-be-born baby. Thank you. That was really sweet.
A hand-knit hat.
A hand-knit hat, yes. It's beautiful. Thank you.
I'm going to do a really quick thank you to Leanna Eaton, who's a podcast fan who showed us around Berlin a few weeks ago and is like the best tour guide and the coolest person who ever lived. So that's my thank you. Okay, our three topics today. First is we're going to talk about the second season of Girls. Second, we're going to talk about whether women tweet differently than men. And third, we will do an interview with our own Emily Bazelon, whose new book, Sticks and Stones, about bullying is out this week. So let's start with Girls. We want to check in on the show's sophomore season. After a debut season that could not have gotten more attention, we want to see if we could still call the show groundbreaking, revolutionary, as many people did in the beginning. Is it fulfilling its first season promise? Is it still making people angry or elated? Or has it just become another show? The living configurations of the four girlfriends at the center of the show have shifted, but it still continues some themes from the first season. Hannah, who's played by the show's creator, Lena Dunham, is still struggling to be a writer and still thinks the world revolves around Hannah. And she also still gets naked a lot, which we will talk about. Also, some of the minor characters, Ray, for example, a dude friend who's now dating Shoshana, are playing more major roles this season. For this conversation, we are joined by David Hagland, Slate's Browbeat editor, who's been conducting a guys on girls conversation for every episode this season. Hi, David.
Hey, Hannah.
So you have expressed, and tell me if I'm reading this wrong, some disappointment with this season. Is that true? And if so, tell us why.
Yeah, that's true. And I've been wondering lately whether it's just that the show felt like such a breath of fresh air when it started, and this season we've just become used to what it is, or whether the show has gone a little bit further in the direction of kind of conventional sitcominess, which has been present to varying degrees, I think, since it started, but feels like a bigger part of the show now. I would say my slight disappointment with the season mostly has to do with its kind of dabbling in more traditional, you know, televisual modes.
What do you mean by that? Do you mean broad humor? Because I sort of feel like it's been kind of inventive. Like almost every episode has been this kind of standalone episode that's felt experimental in how it's structured. And so I'm not quite sure if you mean the humor has gotten too broad or the characters are not going anywhere or moving or developing, or sort of what is it that feels stuck to you?
It does have something to do with the humor. It also has to do with the way guest stars, I think, have been used this season. You know, so Donald Glover from Community played Hannah's boyfriend in the first couple of episodes and then disappeared, presumably forever, which, you know, that's how TV works. You hire an actor for a couple of episodes and then they leave. But, you know, the first season didn't really do that sort of thing. I do also think the humor has gotten a bit more broad. I think this past episode, for instance, the whole storyline with Booth and Marnie felt a bit kind of exaggerated and over the top and not quite as lived in as most of the first season felt to me.
A lot of things that you can sort of see coming. I mean, the right. Like the Booth Marnie thing with her, you know, being asked to host this party with him. And then in the end, it's actually she's supposed to be like sort of the hostess and he wants to pay her. You could see that coming from a mile away. And even though I was not a huge fan of the show last season, I don't think that was always the case. This season seems to be like she took some of the criticisms actually really to heart and is like the Donald Glover character felt to me like a reaction to the criticism of not having a black character. And throughout the season, there have been moments like that where she seems to be like writing a line kind of at us saying sort of F you, and it's not working really. I don't know.
I have enjoyed this season more than last season. I think because I am a 20-something young woman writer living in Brooklyn, I took a lot of the discussion around the first season oddly personally, and now I'm able to just watch it as a TV show and as a really good TV show. And so I've enjoyed the season more. But I will say that, yes, I think she took criticism to heart, but also the episode that probably has gotten the most attention this season, the episode featuring Patrick Wilson, was in some ways kind of a fuck you to the critics, right? Like the episode was titled One Man's Trash, and a lot of the discussion around it, including on Slate, centered around, you know, her display of her body and whether someone who looked like Hannah would realistically sleep with someone who looked like Patrick Wilson, playing this very handsome, very wealthy, very kind doctor with a brownstone in Greenpoint. You know, I think some of that had to be a reaction to the fact that every single interview she gave about the first season, people asked her about her body, and she had to be sick of that. And she turned that into part of what I thought was a very interesting episode. So, David, yeah, we've made you come and atone for your sins. You and Dan Ingber.
And Dan Ingber. Yeah, you know, I think, you know, there are definitely aspects of our exchange that I regret. I think
well,
that
wait,
we...
let's back up because okay. I don't know that all
Wait,
all
let's
of our
even
listeners...
back up more vastly and explain what happens in this episode. So right. Hannah is working at a coffee shop and Patrick Wilson plays this handsome doctor guy who comes into the coffee shop and explains that they've been dumping their coffee shop trash in his personal garbage can and he's pissed off about that. And then Hannah essentially follows him home. And what follows is an entire episode that unfolds in his lovely brownstone, which feels almost like a dream that Hannah is happening, but, you know, it's not really a dream. I mean, she's actually having this encounter with him, which lasts something like 2 days, in which they have interesting sex and play out the arc of a full relationship in a very short span. And she goes from being alluring to being annoying and gets naked a lot. And then the war between the sexes that ensued around this episode was, you know, guys were saying there's no way these two would get together. He's just a perfect dreamboat and she's not really. And it just seemed kind of off base and unrealistic. And then a lot of women, myself included, were arguing that this, you know, sex in girls is often a vehicle for self-knowledge for Hannah. And this was just yet another vehicle for self-knowledge. He was just a prop in her play about herself, as everybody is. But I don't want you to regret what you wrote, David. Don't regret it.
The thing that I regret from the exchange was just that the focus, it was actually more about Patrick Wilson's appearance than Lena Dunham's, whose name, I mean, there is obviously a divide between Lena Dunham and Hannah Horvath. Now, Hannah Horvath is her alter ego, and that divide gets blurry. But I noticed in some of the kind of fury that followed, that divide got blurred even more. And people said, oh, you're attacking Lena Dunham. I mean, it was part of the point of that episode that Hannah was really to some extent, at her most self-involved, as she has been for much of the season. You know, I think, as you said, Hannah, in your own post about the show, the episode had this fantasy quality. I don't think either Dan or I, when we were first responding to it, really picked up on that aspect of the episode. And I don't totally buy that it was sort of a fantasy or a dream sequence, but it was at some remove from the rest of the season. And there did have this dreamlike quality, which partly had to do with, you know, what Patrick Wilson looks like and what his home was like and all of that.
And her fainting in the shower, too.
Yeah.
Right.
I didn't think of it as a dream. I thought of it as a parable. She was learning a lesson from it. And the mm-hmm. lesson that she learned, which I loved and you hated, you wrote a little follow-up saying you relocated your hatred of the episode to
that David doesn't want a brownstone.
Yeah. She has a speech. She has a speech. And one of the things she says in it, you know, she's saying, I realize that I want to be happy. I want all of the things, right? I don't just want to be the successful writer. I want to curl up with the New York Times and I want to like wear a cashmere sweater while I'm doing it, which you found like so bougie and contemptible. And I found heartening.
I don't know if I found it heartening, but I found it incredibly realistic.
Right. Maybe that's
that
a better way of putting it.
Most, you know, 20 or even 30 somethings who cannot have that stuff decide that they don't want it. Like that's like the way to sort of justify your financial failures or whatever your life is. But really, I mean, I have certainly come to feel that if I could actually have the money to have a brownstone in Brooklyn, I'd take it. And I don't think that she's ever been totally believable, or that we're supposed to think she's like completely authentic as this like, you know, off the grid Greenpoint girl. She's just a Greenpoint girl.
Right. But it's also not meant to be the final word. It's just a phases that a woman goes through. You know, it's things that she needs to process as she's growing up and learning about herself. And one of the good things about this show is that you watch her learn in real time, not Hannah Horvath. You know, she's ultimately narcissistic and almost always circles back to the same place. But especially with sex, she's constantly learning about herself. You know, am I the kind of person who can have sex with a guy who used to be gay? Am I the kind of person who likes to participate in somebody's, you know, teenage slut fantasies? Or am I the kind of guy who just wants a guy to take care of me in a nice brownstone? So she's always trying to figure that out about herself.
And I think some of the conversation has focused too much on the material, even though I just did that. It's not just the brownstone. Like, if we're going to buy into my reading of it as a parable, it's more the sort of traditional markers is that she's saying she wants. She wants to have sort of like good but normal sex, and she wants to have like a good but normal guy, and, you know, and live in a house. And those are things that she supposedly moved to Brooklyn to reject. And I think that's a little bit more important in reading that episode.
Right.
Yeah, well, and to you.
No, I think that's right. And I think Dunham, in writing the episode, threw all these things together in a particular way. I mean, in terms of my own reaction, I think it was a very personal one. It's not a knock on the show's quality that Hannah Horvath wants those things. Thinking about it afterwards, I realized the extent to which I was seeing myself in this show and was, you know, really reacting negatively to a turn that I thought this character had taken, even though it is a believable turn for that character to take. But if you think about when she first shows up, she's resistant to go inside. Then she says, you know, oh, you could be some Ted Bundy figure. He was probably nice and clean and had a brownstone. And that's when she decides to go inside. And the materialism of it was part of the point. Then on the other hand, when she has her little speech about wanting to be happy, she does focus more on her sexual past. And, oh, when I was a 3-year-old, I maybe imagined this violation. And now I've been reenacting these feelings in various ways. So it was all of those things together.
Wait, but David, so what is your personal reaction? I'm still not getting what part of that is like touched you personally.
Anyone who lives in New York, you live, and certainly, you know, trying to live here as a writer and editor, you know, you never really have enough money, or most of us don't. And it's, you know, one of the frustrations of being here. And the show has put, you know, sort of privilege on display in various ways and has often examined it. This to me felt like a moment the first time I watched it when that sort of privilege was not being examined. Instead, she just thought, I want that.
Right.
I watched the episode the first time with my girlfriend, and that's what we talked about afterwards. And she thought I was being a little crazy. And in hindsight, maybe I was.
Well, and there's that moment when she's looking out over his deck and his next door neighbors are basically people she otherwise would be hanging out with, like a bunch of, like, you know, dirty kids that are probably, like, you know, stuffed 10 to an apartment next to his gorgeous brownstone. I kind of think that's the, like, that's an interesting moment where you're like, sort of, that's where she belongs, but this is what she ultimately wants and kind of who doesn't. And that part of it didn't make me uncomfortable about myself or about the show. That actually felt on the more realistic side of the show. But I also think, like, I didn't see it as a fantasy. I saw it though, as a standalone thing. Like, mm-hmm. I think Emily Nussbaum called it a bottle episode. I know from talking to David about Louis does this, Louis C.K. on his show very successfully has these kind of standalone episodes that don't relate to anything else, really, but they work. And I'm just curious if you thought this one for you didn't work because the core of her character wasn't there like that.
I mean, there were decisions that she made this time, meaning Dunham made with regard to Hannah.
Yeah.
That to me seemed to come out of nowhere. So when she decides, okay, I'm just going to kiss this guy, when she decides, I'm going to tell him this, I'm going to tell him that, these are the things I want, those didn't seem to me the things that Hannah Horvath, as I knew her, would do.
Because I think that's what this season reveals a little bit, is that these characters are actually not very well developed. I mean, David wrote a post yesterday begging everyone to watch Enlightened, which is the show that comes on after Girls. And that, I think, is like a really interesting comparison because that main female character in that show, she is fully drawn. And these girls are still caricatures in a way. And I think for me, at least by this season, it's become even more of an impediment. And I can see how that would have hurt that episode for you, although I liked the episode.
Maybe that's the thing that we don't know about the show. Is it conscious of, for example, the fact that it equates material success and growing up? Is it conscious of the fact that when it decides that we're going to watch these people grow up in real time, that they actually come across as not that well-developed sitcom characters? In other words, how conscious is it of these artistic decision/mistakes that it's making? There's actually one last topic I want to discuss before we move on, and that's what's happened to the men in the show while we have you on, David.
Mm-hmm.
I thought this last episode, which was about this failed bromance essentially between Ray and Adam and their relationship with their own masculinity, one of the great scenes is when it centers around this dog that needs to be returned to Staten Island because Adam has stolen this dog. And Ray comes into Adam's apartment looking for his book, and he finds Adam seemingly uselessly banging on two planks of wood. It's like a parody of manliness. You know, it's kind of formless masculinity. Like, yes, it's very loud. Yes, it involves a hammer and some wood, but it doesn't seem to be connected to any larger purpose, which is often the case with Adam's banging. Did you think that was a successful portrayal of a male relationship? And is she trying to say something about the men having the same experiences as the women, basically feeling vulnerable and lost and not quite sure of their place in this world?
Well, it gets complicated with that episode when you say, is she trying to say something? Because that episode was, at least in terms of the credits, written by this guy, Murray Miller, who's also written for American Dad and King of the Hill and these other shows. And then it was directed by Claudia Vey. You know, I thought that Ray came across really well in the episode. My speculation was that Miller, you know, really kind of saw something in that character. Adam, I don't think this particular episode added that much to him. I mean, he's sort of still upset about Hannah in a particular way, and he's banging away at things in his apartment. I talked about the episode with Chris Wade on Slate, and he made some interesting points about Ray. I can't remember if it was Chris or a commenter. Someone described him as a cautionary tale for these wannabe bohemians in Brooklyn. He's almost 10 years older than most of them, and things are not going well. He obviously doesn't have much money. He's living with Shoshana essentially out of necessity and working at this coffee shop. And, you know, that's one of the things, and certainly not the worst thing that can happen when someone is trying to get by in New York. In the past, we've seen him play music, so presumably has some sort of, at least at one point, had some sort of musical ambition. And things are not really working out. And I thought it was interesting to see the show depict that.
Yeah, I think Ray is the most interesting character on Girls right now. And I wonder if, not to take anything away from Lena Dunham's vision, I think she's preternaturally mature, but I also wonder if, like, Judd Apatow and Jenny Connor and some of the people in their 40s maybe who surround her creatively on this have maybe planted the seed in her that maybe this would be an interesting place to experiment, like the darkness of being at a place where you should be a real adult and not having the tools in your toolkit to be a real adult.
Yeah, and I also think the show has become more of an ensemble show, both on the creative side and, you know, in the cast.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, developing more characters at greater length. But also, like I said, so Murray Miller wrote this episode. There have been a range of directors. You know, in fact, you know, the episode Romance Trash we're talking about is, seems to me, the only one that really stands out as very much Lena Dunham's, you know, half hour.
Did she direct it?
No.
No, Richard Shepherd directed that one, but she wrote it. And I think she has directed an episode or two so far as well. But she was sort of pushing Hannah, you know, into the corner in some of the episodes. And I thought sometimes that worked very well.
Yeah. So if we agree maybe that not all the characters are so well developed and it's got broad humor, why are we all so obsessed with it still?
This is another thing that I think I sort of owned up to for myself in reflecting on One Man's Trash, which is that, you know, it's been pointed out a million times, but this show depicts lives that people who write for magazines in New York are familiar with. There's just no way around that. And I think the show is terrific on its own terms, regardless of subject matter. I think that Lena Dunham is a brilliant writer and director. I thought Tiny Furniture was great. But, you know, this is a milieu that people who are writing for Slate or The Times or New York or wherever else are going to recognize.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I have friends who are not writers and are just sort of like young people. And I think they are a little bit obsessed with it because it's a depiction of young womanhood, right?
Right.
In a more realistic way than you're often going to see on the network. So I think like on the original terms, it is still interesting.
I was just going to say that the lack of polish works for me. I mean, I think about what the show would be like if it had the polish, the writing polish of New Girl or Sex and the City. It would be a completely different show. So it's hard to imagine this show without some of its kind of flaws and stumbles in its writing and character development. It's just all part of the experience for me.
I continue to think it's not worth all the talk. I mean, I think this season is proving that.
I do think Enlightened is better.
Yes, watch it.
I haven't seen it yet. I know I have to.
Good.
I have to.
All right. Well, let's end it there. David, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Our second topic is whether men and women tweet differently. But before we move on to that, I want to thank our loyal sponsor, Audible.com. Audible offers over 100,000 audiobooks as well as almost any form of enlightened chatter available on the internet. And you can listen to it on practically any device, including the one you're listening to us on right now. And for XX listeners who are not already Audible members, you get a free audiobook of your choice when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at the URL audiblepodcast.com/XX. Not XX, but XX. The book I'm going to recommend this week is Lauren Groff's Arcadia, which we discussed on the Audio Book Club coming up and which I thought was just fabulous. I'm a huge, huge fan. So I listened to part of it online and read part of it before the Audio Book Club, and both forms were wonderful. So that's my recommendation. If you sign up, you also get a free subscription to either the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal Daily Audio Digest. So give it a try today. audiblepodcast.com/XX. Okay, now let's move on to our second topic. A new study of Twitter users shows that men and women do, in fact, tweet differently. Women use different kinds of emoticons, and they use something called expressive lengthening, which I'm not sure I can do in speech, but it's something like God, like G-A-W-W-W-D, or no way, with lots and lots of Ys, and more repeated exclamation marks and other ticks of expression, while men tend to swear more. So are we looking at another case where women are at the forefront of expressive innovation? Or is this the same old gender ticks and divisions moved into social media? But before we talk about that, Noreen, can you describe a little more of the key differences that this particular study found?
Sure. I mean, you hit on a few of them, but, you know, a million exclamation marks. You aren't going to see a lot of guys who put that much enthusiasm into their tweeting per this study. Women also tend to, you know, in addition to something like OMG, they'll also tend to express something more like uncertainty. There are more things like ah and hmm, ugh and grr that women use. Men use fewer forms of affirmations like yeah and yeah, but what they do use, which will not be a surprise to anyone who has communicated online with a man, is nah, like N-A-H, just like nah. So when I was thinking about the study, I didn't think of it quite as narrowly as being Twitter communication, but more being online communication. For me personally, my Twitter is somewhat professional, but when I G-chat, I certainly do a lot of the things that are associated with women in this study. You know, for instance, I will use a million L's when I want to tell someone something is cool. I will certainly throw an OMG in there. I won't use an LOL because I'm philosophically opposed to that because I'm not actually laughing out loud. I did see myself reflected back in that, and I'm curious if you guys did or if maybe it's a little bit of a generational thing or...
I think it's really inefficient. I mean, on Twitter, like, why would you use, like, that's the one thing that struck me is, like, you waste based your characters on lots of extra O's and Y's. I know that's a lame thing to say. I don't really use, like, I would never do Oh My God unselfconsciously. I do WTF is just about the only one that I do, I think.
I don't know that I do all of those things. And I think a lot of, it's a little bit of a generational thing. But I do think, like, in the both in the way that we talk, we write, not just on Twitter, but even the way that we blog. It's all of a piece. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing that the study said that men do, mm-hmm. they swear more. And I find myself sort of hesitating probably at swearing on Twitter more than maybe my male counterparts would.
That might be true.
So on our blog, Amanda Marcotte talked about this as an innovation, you know, yet another one of these cases where women were pioneers on some, you know, verbal written front. It didn't strike me as that way because a lot of these things were not that innovative. You know, these are written forms of things that people say out loud.
Isn't that innovative, though? It's a new way of creating language, right? It's a language that's reflecting the way we talk now. I mean, we did this whole section on Vocal Fry.
Yeah.
And actually, after we did that segment, I sent you guys an email saying, I realize I do vocal fry in my written work, and it's when I extend the words with like a million vowels or a million consonants, just like word with like 12 million D's, you know, that's right. Vocal fry in the written form. And I think that's sort of a creative way. It's a new way of playing with language.
Maybe innovator is not exactly the right word, but like leader, because mm-hmm. I think Amanda Marcotte's point was just that. And another study that she cited, this is talking about linguistic trends, were you talk to an old, not web savvy man. And if you want to see where they're going, you talk to a young web savvy girl. And so the point is just that whatever we're tweeting now in 2 years, that's what our boyfriends and husbands and
do you believe that?
Tweeting.
I mean, leaders need followers, right? Like, are guys going to start putting tons of exclamation points, or is the idea that they'll pick up some of this but not others?
From what I remember of Slate email from when I worked here, there were certainly a lot of exclamation points coming from men. I think that
Hannah's husband,
big fan of the exclamation point. I think there is a certain emotional subtlety to, you're laughing probably at this, but I think there is a certain emotional subtlety to, you know, saying before you say a statement of fact. You know, in a GChat or in a tweet, you're sort of giving a little bit of a side eye, right? You're saying, well, yeah, I'm going to say this, but I don't really mean it, right? And I think that that degree of sophistication is something that anyone who's interested in being the best communicator they can be is going to want to put into their, you know, online presence.
Another question that Amanda Marcotte brought up in her post, reacting to the original study in the BuzzFeed post, was that the way we speak using vocal fry or uptalk or upspeak, whatever you call it, is basically subconscious. But when we're tweeting or we're posting to Facebook or we're, you know, writing online and social media in various forms, we actually can put thought into those things. I mean, we compose our tweet and then we have to shorten it to make it fit, or we have to. And so is there actually a line? Is it different? Are Twitter linguistics more crafted and therefore less likely to kind of be picked up by the rest of culture?
I love that point because it's not subconscious. It takes it out of this realm of analysis, and maybe we would say condescending analysis, which says that women subconsciously transmit their insecurity in their speech, because you're not subconscious when you're tweeting. I mean, it takes a moment.
Unless younger women are. I mean, I don't know. Maybe that, you know.
Yeah, I think maybe not everyone is as worried about their tweets being such a part of their public persona as people who are journalists, for instance, might. Like, you know, I have friends who just use it as a way of communicating with other friends. And so you might just type it the way you would type a text or a GChat, which is more quickly and some thought, but, you know, you're not worried about this being preserved in the Library of Congress necessarily, which these are.
Yeah. If you watch your parents ever, if anyone has ever watched their parent compose an email, it's just dreadfully, it's just painful. My mom like does so much like deleting and rewriting and proofreading, and oh, it takes forever for 3 sentences. Hi, Mom. I guess with every generation that we get a little easier on ourselves.
Yeah, my dad writes the most beautiful texts in the world. They're signed and everything. I asked him once how long it takes him to write a text, and not sarcastically, he said, not long, 10 minutes. I couldn't stop laughing for like 4 days after that. He's wonderful. Great, great texter, my dad.
I do have certain relationships that happen primarily on email, which are somewhere between like tweeting and texting and actually writing. And I think those might be my favorites. You know, they're sort of slightly constructed, but not too constructed. And they go on. And I really like those.
So we'll end this one on a question mark, exclamation point. Question mark.
An ellipsis, a dot, dot, dot. The undermining, yeah, I don't know what's going on here kind of thing.
Or maybe I do.
Or maybe I do. Huh? Mm-hmm. So let's move on to our third topic. Slate's own Emily Bazelon has just written a new book, Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. The book centers around the stories of three kids who have gone through truly harrowing situations, and Emily tracks the reaction of their friends, their schools, their parents, and the courts. The inspiration for the project is a series Slate readers will recognize about Phoebe Prince, a teenager in Massachusetts who was bullied and then killed herself. And it offers deep insight into how bullying has changed in the internet age and also what the most helpful things we can do about it are. Emily, welcome to the show.
Hey, I'm so glad to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. It's so nice to have you back. I have to say, having just read your book and listened to your various glamorous interviews on Colbert and Terry Gross, both of which were fabulous, one of the most disturbing ideas in your book for me is how in the online age, bullying unfolds 24/7. Like a kid really can't escape it, which is something I've never thought of. Can you explain that idea a little bit?
Well, you know, it used to be, and this happened to me in eighth grade, that if people were making you really miserable in school, you would go home at the end of the day and you would have a break. And you could cry your heart out. You could talk to your parents. You could just have some hours to yourself. And now what happens is kids often bring the baggage from school to the internet. And then you have this kind of this terrible feeling that people are talking about you online. Mm-hmm. And often parents will say to kids, well, if this is happening, well, just don't look. Don't go on Facebook. If people are saying mean things about you, just like pretend. But it's very hard, I think, for anyone to do that. If you think that people are gossiping about you, then you look, and then it's hard not to feed it, which can then just like keep it going. So I think that's the really damaging part of the way that the internet has affected bullying among kids.
Yeah, I really had this powerful vision of like a boy girl sitting in their bed, like trying to get some sleep, like thinking, what are people posting now? I mean, it really feels like it's in your bedroom all the time because you could just flip open your laptop and, you know, there would be the nasty words about you right there.
Exactly. And sometimes when you follow these threads over the course of an evening or even a couple of days, and you can see exactly what all the timestamps are for the post. So you can literally see the whole thing unfold. And I've read through some of these long threads in which you see the victim start out kind of trying to brashly defend herself and then realize that that has just like added to this cycle of conflict and then become more and more cringing and cowering. It's really kind of creepy to watch.
How does that actually work for the bully? Because I assume that bullies in school bully for a certain reason. They have kids around them that they're trying to impress, or that there's a social in-person aspect to that, that then when they go home and they're alone in their rooms with their computers, why does that carry on for them at home?
Well, they often still feel like they have an audience. And in fact, they may have a bigger audience online because teenagers tend to, on Facebook, for example, friend hundreds of other kids. So you have this potential to reach lots of people. And I think the other thing that's really problematic is this mismatch. So to the bully, to the kid who's writing the mean post, there's no face-to-face contact. You don't see the effect you're having on someone, and you don't have the same kind of prompts toward empathy you might have in person.
Right.
And then you put something out there and it feels permanent and lasting and has the potential to go viral. And that makes it much more damaging for the victim. So it's as if the kids who are bullying don't quite realize sometimes the impact they're having, and yet this forum makes things more indelible.
And just to add a third thing to that perfect storm is the impulse control problem, right? This idea that it's so easy to post things online, much easier than it is to say, you know, work up your guts to shove someone against the locker. And so you combine that with these sort of not quite yet developed impulse control of a teenager, and you can just text some nasty thing really quickly. And that's, you know, yet a third kind of disaster caused by online bullying, right?
Right. This really hits kids in a developmental weak spot because the parts of their brains that are still maturing are the ones that deal with impulse control. I do want to say, because we're making this sound so awful, I think it can really be horrible, but it's also important to just point out that in our generation, kids were getting beaten up a lot more than they are now. So I don't feel like it's accurate to think that cyberbullying has made things demonstrably worse and terrible. It has just changed the equation.
The kids aren't waiting for you outside in the parking lot to beat you up. They're waiting to get home.
Yeah, not as much. I mean, the rates of school violence are really down.
And what about the consequences? Are there more consequences now that it's sort of trackable for schools and for parents? Or is it, you know, in this gray area where it's not quite the school's problem, it's not quite the parents' problem, it's no one's problem? Maybe it's Facebook's problem.
It's not enough Facebook's problem, okay. I think Facebook actually could do more. But yes and no, both mm-hmm. is the answer. On the one hand, you have this record. You have evidence of what's going on. And that can be really useful to parents who are trying to protect their kids. The other side of it, though, is do we really want schools to be policing every single thing kids write online? You know, what should the standard be? Is writing online really different from shouting at someone on the street or on the beach? You wouldn't expect schools to discipline a student who, you know, yelled slut at someone in the public square. So those are issues the courts are really just starting to take on and that schools have to grapple with all the time.
How widespread are lawsuits?
There are a whole bunch of them percolating up through the courts. So it's definitely starting to play out. But in the meantime, the administrators have to decide what to do, right? Because yeah. And one standard I find useful that one of the schools I wrote about used was this idea, okay, we're not going to intervene online unless we see something that we think is a risk to a student's safety.
Is that a hard line, though? I mean, I'm curious. You've looked at more of these cases than probably, you know, certainly than most people. And I just wonder, like, when you look back on the kids who've committed suicide or have done harm to themselves, can you see, if you look backward, oh, that line was crossed, whereas in these other cases, it was more benign. It's just kind of like typical bullying that we all have to, it's just a part of life. Or is it not that easy to define?
You know, in some cases, you can see things that at least in hindsight look really scary. And other cases, no. And in at least in the cases I've really delved into, in fact, the in-person bullying has always been worse than what happened online. And so to some degree, the online record is not misleading, but it's just really incomplete. And this is the hard thing about bullying, right? Like most people recover from it. And it's a form of adversity that it's super unpleasant and can be damaging, but it also is something that you can move on from. But for some people, that's not true. And actually, there happens to be this new study out this week in which some researchers at Duke did the first 20-year study to see what kinds of long-term psychological impacts bullying had. And it was really significant. Both victims and kids who both bully and are victims, that's a third category, they suffered 20 years later to higher degrees of anxiety disorders and depression.
Not people who were just simply bullies, though?
That's simply bullies, people had a higher risk of antisocial personality disorder. A little different.
Weren't they already displaying some of that?
I think so.
Can we talk a little bit about the difference between boys and girls? You write about one girl, Monique. It's a very sad story. I was glad that her mother was helping her out a lot in that situation. Right. But she was both bullied in person and bullied online and bullied in all sorts of ways and had to leave school like other kids in your book. But one thing her case brought up for me is the way in which online bullying has leveled the playing field, because if you're not doing physical bullying as much anymore, I mean, girls can really play that game well. And so some of the emails and other things that you quoted from her friends are just, you know, depressing and horrifying. And mm-hmm. even your conversations with her friends, they didn't really have, you know, they had some amount of empathy, but not a tremendous amount of empathy. And I just wonder if in this new landscape of bullying, girls play as hard as boys.
Girls socialize more online. So when you study how many texts a day kids send, girls send an average of 90 a day as teenagers, and boys send an average of 50. And girls also spend
90 texts a day.
Yes,
blows my mind.
Can I tell you, though, I then looked at my 13-year-old's texts, and he is sending about 50 a day.
Wow. Saying what? Yeah. Can you say what they say, honestly?
I'm like, not allowed to look. This is a mistake I made, actually, because I should have, when I gave him his phone, my advice to people is in the beginning, you should look and see what kids are writing. What I should have said to him was, look, this is this new world you're entering, and I want to make sure you can handle it. But I just gave him the phone. And so then a month later, when I looked at the bill and then wanted to look and see what he was texting, he was outraged. He felt like his trust had been totally betrayed.
Did you tell him before you looked?
Yeah, I said, can I have the phone? I just want to look. I just want to make sure things are okay. And he was like, everything's fine, and I can't believe you're asking me this. And then I, you know, felt like I had completely blown it. So,
can I highlight that by the way, Emily? I think that's a really, really important point, and I am completely taking your example on this. Although I've already screwed it up with my eldest daughter, which is that you and I think that's one of the urgent points of your book is do it early, make it completely normalize this idea, make it a kind of teaching thing. I mean, some kids will just be too sassy and still be annoyed by it, but say like, what comes with this phone or what comes with this computer or whatever is that I'm going to help you figure out how to navigate this world. You had pretty good language around this. And I'm going to talk to you about the dangers of it, you know, almost like the sex talk you would give.
Right. Or the go out at midnight on your own talk. Right. and right. behavior. Right. You don't just open the door.
So you start that way and then you ease off. Like as you see that they can handle it and they have the lessons in place, it doesn't mean that everything is going to go right after you give that talk. But I think the fact that you messed it up and did it later and then the kid gets resentful and says, oh, you don't trust me. That's like really, really important for parents to know that you do it first and then you kind of ease off into trust and just kind of stay lightly aware of what your child is doing. That seems like a much better pattern to set.
In my mind of the school, like hold off as long as you can to give the kid these things.
You can do that too.
However, then if they're so old, when you finally give it to them, they're sophisticated enough to create various online personas.
Yeah, you should be
really
so
tracking.
Lucky they would be that old. I mean, look, part of this is also you have to judge your kid and you have to instill right. the values you want your kid to have in a lot of other ways. But I do think you're right, Hannah, that in the beginning you give the talk and then you also monitor. You check out what's happening and then you let your kid earn more freedom.
Before we move on to solutions, can we talk about the Phoebe Prince case? Since that's the case you did the most reporting on for Slate, there's a lot of new information and new perspectives in your book that were not in your original series. I think one really nice thing you did is you talked to one of the people accused in that case. Can you talk a little bit about what that experience was like and what you learned through talking to her?
There were six kids who faced serious criminal charges after the death of Phoebe Prince. And they were charges in which the kids were being directly blamed for her death, which is really unusual in a suicide to see any kind of criminal liability like that. And one of the girls, whose name is Flannery Mullins, had had a situation with Phoebe a few weeks before Phoebe died in which Phoebe made a play for her boyfriend. This guy, Austin, you know, had sex with Phoebe, really surprised Flannery that that had happened. And then Flannery started hearing that Phoebe thought that Austin was going to go out with her instead of Phoebe. And Flannery got upset. She said something in gym class to the effect of someone ought to kick that girl's ass. And they were called into the principal's office together because the teacher overheard and given a talking to. But Flannery had never been in trouble before. And so they were sent out, both Flannery and Phoebe, with warnings, but no punishment. And Flannery actually heeded the warnings. You know, she says, and there's no evidence to the contrary, that she didn't talk to Phoebe after that. But then 2 weeks later, after Phoebe had committed suicide, she was one of the kids who there were a lot of rumors about that she'd had all of this conflict with Phoebe. And then in the wake of this incredibly sad death, there was this real drive to punish and to blame that Flannery very much got caught up in.
And where is that now?
Well, in the end, you know, these cases petered out because the criminal charges were so heavy-handed and just overreacting. Only one kid in the end pled guilty to one harassment misdemeanor. And Flannery and the other girls involved accepted responsibility for various minor misdemeanors, but with the agreement that if they made it to the age of 18, their records would be clean. So I think Flannery has a lot of ways moved on from this experience. She's finished at a community college, is getting ready to apply to a four-year college. But this is just a huge upheaval in her life. It was both the charges and the intense national and international media attention. It really turned her into a pariah in her world. And for me, this is a story not about complete blamelessness or innocence, but a story about proportionality. You know, when we make examples of a few kids and label them bullies, and then they become kind of the national punching bag for this whole issue, then they're really suffering for that role that they're playing.
You know, you don't say this outright, but you suggest this, particularly through the voice of another parent, that this was effectively more a social cathartic process than it was a legal process, that this was about finding someone to blame. You know, clearly lots of people were at fault. I mean, her parents had issues in their marriage. She had just moved from overseas. She had a history of depression. There was a lot of different factors that went into Phoebe Prince killing herself, including her own, you know, history of depression. And yet, you know, the bully story is one that we would really like to cling to, right? I mean, is that part of what goes on here?
Yes, I think that's true. And, you know, I talked to one expert who I thought said something so interesting. She said, you know, we've had waves in which we blame single parents for kids' problems, or we blame divorce. Like, we think we have this vector that explains these really complicated issues that teenagers face. And I think in that moment where these kids were charged and Phoebe Prince's suicide got called a bully side, a term which has sadly stuck with us to some degree, there's this idea that we have found the explanation happen. And now we understand this incredibly tragic, difficult, complicated phenomenon of teenage suicide. And the problem is that it's just really misleading, because the evidence all shows that while bullying can be a factor and can be a trigger, what really is the underlying important risk factor is depression and mental health.
Are suicide rates that much drastically up in the past? They're down. That's
teenage suicide rates are down since the early 80s. But from the media coverage, I don't think you would ever know that. Right. Yeah.
Let's move on in this last segment to solutions. One impression I get from your book is that solutions can come from different places. There are these isolated heroes. They can be a guidance counselor. They can be a fellow kid who reaches out and offers to be a friend. And I wasn't sure if I should be heartened by that or saddened by that. Like, is it just case by case and localized? Like, maybe you can tell the story of the guidance counselor who did the right thing, which I think is a nice example.
That is a great story. But before I tell that story, it isn't just isolated cases. I think the overall important message I have about solutions is it's about changing the culture of a community or a school so that kids don't become more popular and more powerful by being really mean. Mm-hmm. That's the underlying dynamic you want to shift, right?
How do you shift that? I mean, that goes back to cavemen. Like, I just...
There are schools in which that's not how it works, and you don't become the most popular by being the cruelest, right? And it's all about social norms and convincing kids. Like, most kids don't approve of bullying, and most kids don't do it. So you have that to go on. And think about drunk driving rates. I mean, when we were growing up, drunk driving, if you had asked me when I was 16, I would have told you that I thought it was kind of cool.
Not when I was in high school.
Right.
It was not cool.
It was not cool. We shifted that whole norm. In a lot of ways, schools did work on this, and there was mass media campaigns. That norm really changed. So I don't think – I mean, which isn't to say the kids are always going to be nice to each other.
Yeah.
But that's not what bullying is about. Bullying is this particular form of merciless, harmful aggression that takes place over time and involves a power imbalance. And that is not something we have to just, like, give up on.
I would say we're in the middle of shifting that culture. I mean, my experience in schools is that they take this stuff extremely seriously. I mean, my daughter's middle school is plastered from basement to ceiling with
posters about
posters and education. And I'm not sure that they're doing the exact, you know, you outline some pretty good models for how to change the culture of the school. I'm not sure they're doing those perfect models, but they certainly talk about it. And I actually ran an essay class in my daughter's school last year and asked them to answer certain questions about bullying. It was clear that the preponderance of emotion was against it.
Oh, I want to read those. That's so great.
Yeah.
So should we talk briefly about Lauren Moss, the heroic guidance counselor?
Let's end on that, since that's a really nice story, because she did the right thing.
I agree. So this is a guidance counselor in Freedom Middle School outside of Atlanta in Georgia. And she had a student come into her office really distraught over posts that were going up on a social media site called FormSpring. And FormSpring is a site where it's very easy to be anonymous and to say things that lots of people can see. And these posts were encouraging this girl to commit suicide. They were disclosing some really private details about her family. And she was really upset about it, felt very vulnerable. And so Lauren listened to the story and applied the standard, you know, is this potentially a risk to this girl's safety, and decided that she thought that it was. So she decided she was going to go on FormSpring and see what was going on. She couldn't get into it in school because the internet censors at school were blocking the site. So she went home one night and she logged on, she started an account, and she started looking at the things these kids were posting, not just about this girl, but other posts about cutting and drinking that was going on. And she found it really dismaying. She felt like she'd uncovered this kind of underbelly of this middle school. And so then she took note of the kids she really thought were signaling trouble. And she called those parents, let them know what was going on. And then she wrote a note on the victim's page that she knew everyone would see that said, look, you know, this is Lauren Moss. I'm your guidance counselor. I just want you guys to know I'm here and I'm seeing some things I really find disturbing. And she also reported the abuse to FormSpring that accomplished nothing. The site didn't respond to her. But she found that from her post, a whole bunch of kids decided to get off the site. Mm-hmm. And given the toxic effect it was having in the school, that seemed like it was a pretty good intervention. And what I really appreciated about talking to her was she had really thought about this. Am I crossing a line into their private zone? Why am I here? Am I handling this right? I felt like she'd put enormous care into it.
The Tammy Taylor of
Freedom Middle School.
Yeah. I have to say, Emily, that your book is full of such examples, things that schools did in individual cases that was misguided, things that schools and counselors or kids did that were really helpful. So in that sense, I think there's a lot that a lot of different people can learn and take from the book. Parents, educators, you know, lots of people out there can learn about bullying and what to do about it.
Thank you, Hannah. Yeah, I definitely don't want the message to be that everyone should just throw up their hands in fear, because there are really strategies and steps you could take. So I definitely try to spend a lot of time outlining them.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Emily.
Thank you.
Okay, let's move on to our recommendations. I will go first this week. I am going to recommend this photo slideshow, which Jessica Gross posted on in the XX Factor about the reborn movement. It's a slideshow by a woman named Rebecca Martinez. The reborn movement are women who carry around very lifelike infant dolls and nurture them throughout the day. They really treat them as if they have an infant. And there are all sorts of reasons why the women do this. They do this either because they couldn't have children, or they had lots of children but don't anymore, or they were midwives, or they just have a lot of excess nurture energy that they need to get out of their system. And I found the photos really, really, really fascinating. They really have the kind of newborn mom shtick down to the tired face and the putting the newborns in all these kind of padded places. And it's really just kind of amazing, I thought. Okay, Noreen, what do you have for us?
I have been listening to a new group that I discovered recently, kind of obsessively. It's called First Aid Kit, and it's a Swedish like folk pop duo. It's two women who, you know, feminism and pop music really doing well in Sweden. The first song on their, or maybe the second song on their album, is the song Emmy Lou, which I really love and have been playing on repeat.
I just discovered them myself. I'm totally with you on that one.
They're great.
I love Swedish pop. Okay, Allison, your turn.
After you guys expressing your love for Swedish pop, I'm going to be an old fogey. And Noreen, you can roll your eyes, because I think this might be the second podcast in a row that I have recommended a nostalgic music documentary. But after that Beyonce documentary that we're not talking in the podcast because we just talked about Beyonce, but I really didn't like it, I was pleased to watch The History of the Eagles, a 3+ hour Eagles documentary on Showtime. Let me just say,
Wait, are you actually like a 65-year-old man?
I know.
Have you been hiding that from us?
I don't even like the Eagles. And this movie made me possibly like their music even less. It's worth watching it just because music history. Just watch it. You have to enjoy this stuff. I love these things.
My bad boyfriend memories are overwhelming me right now from, you know, the boyfriend
okay,
who loved the
yeah,
Eagles.
I am your ex-boyfriend. But also, Don Henley, I've been tweeting about this. I don't think I've gotten one response or retweet to these tweets, but Don Henley was so hot and so cool back then.
He's really not now,
but I'm gonna hopefully on our page I can post an old picture of him, which I've also been tweeting again. Like nobody has reacted, so maybe it's my personal taste. But one, I really liked it just for looking at Don Henley, and I've spent like a lot of time since watching it just like scrolling through Google Images trying to find pictures.
Wait, I'm looking right now on my computer.
Me too.
Is it
that? No, but you have to find old, like really old ones. So
I
just
don't
wait. I'll send you I'll
with his fro.
Is
it the fro?
With the fro.
Okay.
With the fro.
All right. I can see it. He's got the nice eyes and this
and
one.
He's
and
like,
the flannel.
And you see in the documentary, he's just cool. Like, whatever he's wearing is very cool. Like, he's always just like, he's cool
next to
Glenn Frey, who's a big tool the whole time. But also, I'm sorry, I'm going on and on. But also, at the very end, when they do their reunion tour, and Don Henley, old man now, is talking about how, you know, Neil Young once said, it's better to burn out than to rust, and that he disagrees, and that, you know, rust can be a beautiful thing. And I found myself like totally moved by that. And I could feel as I'm watching this documentary that I'm switching sides. And which, like 5 years ago, I would have been embarrassed by this and they should just give up and stop playing music. I was actually in their court, so I don't know what's happening to me. But that's my recommendation.
All right. Well, I'm fresh from karaoke night last night with the Slate crew, so I'm all about the Eagles and Beyonce both in one karaoke room in one night. All right. Well, thank you both for joining me. I'd like to thank Abdullah Rufus for producing this podcast and also mention that Abdul has his own podcast going on now, which is called DJ Grandpa's Crib, which I have listened to, and it's very awesome. It covers the Kickstarter community and interviews lots of people. He calls it Hope and Prosperity During Challenging Times. It's a very cool podcast, which you can find out about on djgrandpa.com. I'd like to thank Andy Bowers, who's the executive producer of all the Slate podcasts. As always, always come on our XX Facebook page and tell us what you want us to blog about or talk about. For Noreen and Allison, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will see you in a couple of weeks. Bye. Well, I've been running down the road, trying to loosen my load. Got a world of trouble on my mind. Looking for a lover who won't blow my cover. She's so hard to find. Take it easy. Take it easy. Don't let the sound of your own.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.